And in a moment, you're going to hear a fascinating discussion with Mary Roach. We're going to be talking about Grunt, the Curious Science of Humans at War. She's also written a couple other works called Packing for Mars and Stiff, the Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. So we've got lots to talk about in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mary Roach, author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. She has written columns, essays, feature articles for several national publications. Mary was a National Magazine Award finalist back in 95. In 1996, she took the American Engineering Association's Media Award in the category of General Interest Magazines. She's always gravitated toward the peculiar. She covers things like, what do Eskimos eat? Killer bees? Carrot addiction, amputee bowling leagues, strange stories, but I love them, Mary. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thanks.
You were on with my colleague Ian about 3 years ago.
I was, I think, a couple of times.
Yeah, so it's good to have you back.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, now, what have you been doing in these 3 years that you've been away?
Well, I have been working on this book, Grunt, which
I love that name, by the way.
Well, it's got to be the one, syllable, one word title. I've been working on it's military science, but it's a specific side of it. It's kind of the white hat side of it. It's not weapons and bombs and killing. It's more the helping people deal with things like extreme heat and flies and. Fire and bombs from underneath a vehicle, and also escaping from a submarine and shark repellent. So my curiosity kind of takes me to some unusual spots, but it's the science of the soldier, really, the human body.
So how do you start this? You pick a topic like extreme heat, for example, and then you do what? You interview soldiers on how they handle themselves in extreme heat? What do you do?
No, not so much because they call me a science writer, though I don't have a science degree. So I'm usually spending time with researchers. So in the case of extreme heat, I was in the cook box, which is what they call the lab where they're studying heat stroke and heat injury, which obviously in the last couple of conflicts has been a serious problem. So this was at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, USIS, and they had a couple of Army Ranger instructors in the cook box, which is this chamber that you go into, and they can turn it on, and they can set the humidity and the heat. And there's a couple of treadmills that were set for a slight incline, and so they had it was about 100 degrees, and they were taking blood samples. They're trying to figure out a way to identify who's really susceptible to heat injury, and so that hopefully those soldiers would then wouldn't be put in a high exertion situation, super hot scenario. So anyway, I was in there with them. It was kind of an eye opener because I've not served in the military. I'm not anywhere near as fit as an Army Ranger instructor, but these guys were unbelievable. They were able to keep going for the full hour. They threw a pack on me that was about a third as much as what a soldier would be carrying
right.
In a reality situation. I lasted 7 minutes, and that was enough. That was it for me.
Well, but you're not a trained soldier, you know? What the heck?
No, that's true. That's true. But anyway, so I was reporting about the science of heat stroke and sweating and how, you know, important it is to sweat. And it was interesting because these guys, they started sweating right away, and I thought, God, I seem to be more fit than them. But in fact, if you are acclimated to the heat and you're good at surviving in it, you start sweating heavily and right away. Whereas my body was just kind of like, is it hot in here? I didn't know. I'd like a popsicle. So in fact, these guys who, you know, appeared to be struggling, in fact, that was just their body being really efficient in high heat. So and you adjust in a few days. Like they would send soldiers for a couple of days in Kuwait City just to acclimate to the heat before going on to Afghanistan.
I'm going to go through a couple of topics that are in your book, and we'll go through each one and get your takes on some of that. If we have time tonight, too, I'd love to talk with you about your Mars book. And we'll get into that, too. Now, you talk about the conundrum of military noise. What do you mean by that, and how does that affect people?
Well, the military, I mean, being in the military, is, as anyone knows, is a lot of noise, not just gunfire and explosions, but also if you're traveling by a helicopter, like a Black Hawk helicopter, you're in a personnel carrier. These are really loud vehicles. They're not a Lexus, and you're in them for hours at a time. So there's a tremendous amount of hearing loss. It's the number one, I believe, VA expenditure as of now. So and the problem, it's easy enough to put on. You can protect ears. You can put in earplugs. You can put on a ear cuffs. But then you lose, as a soldier, you're a Marine, you're going to lose what they call situational awareness. So you're not going to hear somebody shouting at you, giving you directions, or you won't be able to tell which way is gunfire coming from. So soldiers tend to not, they'd rather lose some hearing than lose their life. So there's technology that's pretty amazing, kind of cool. It's these cuffs you put on over your ears, but they dampen the loud noise, but they also amplify like the human voice. So you almost have like bionic hearing where you could hear somebody. I tried them on, and you could hear somebody two car lengths away having a conversation. So and there's a communication thing built in. I kind of want a set. They were pretty cool, but there's a push to get those right now. Special operations are the main groups that have those, and not everybody on the ground's got them, and so there's some folks who are pushing to try to get those available for everyone, because so many people come away with hearing loss and tinnitus as well, and there's nothing, as far as I know, nothing to be done to cure tinnitus. Hearing loss, you can, hearing aids, there's that, but it's amazing, there was a bunch of special operations guys meeting with these military audiologists, and there were some guys who are like in their 40s with hearing aids, and they're just like, you expect when you leave, you're going to take some hearing loss with you, and that's kind of awful.
Mary, did you get into weaponry at all? Because, don't we have the kinds of weapons that would create such a horrible hearing noise that it would render somebody, down to their knees?
If you weren't wearing, there's stuff that is so loud. An M16 is about 160 decibels, where just one exposure, if you don't have hearing protection, you can have some hearing loss. Normally it's like the amount of time you're exposed, it plays into it, but these things are so loud that just a second or a split second will damage your hearing. And an anti-tank weapon, which I thought it's like 187 decibels. It's instant hearing loss if you're not protected, for sure. You mean like a weapon that would use loud noise?
Yes.
At the enemy?
High pitched or something, right at
people.
Yeah,
there was
crowd control, something like that.
Infrasound. There was an infrasound project that the military looked into. Infrasound is long, slow wavelengths, and it can set up kind of a resonant frequency with certain organs in the body, like it kind of makes your eyeballs vibrate and your internal organs. It can make some people are very susceptible, makes them nauseous. You would read sort of exaggerations about how it would make you lose control of your bowels and you become sort of a dithering jellyfish. I think that those are an exaggeration, and I don't think that it was ever deployed by any military, but there were definitely papers written on infrasound as a possible non-lethal weapon, for sure.
We're with Mary Roach talking about her latest book called Grunt. How'd you get that title?
Well, we got stiff, spook, bonk, gulp. They've all been one syllable. This one, because it focuses on the human being, it's not a weapons technology book, so that's a nice slang for the the guy who deals with heat and heavy loads and exhaustion and flies and everything else. So grunt, you know, as a slang for Marine or infantry.
Now, you've written a chapter on maggot therapy. What
I have.
The heck are we talking about?
The maggot is, in fact, kind of an amazing medical tool. It is, honestly, this is true. The maggot is an FDA-approved medical device, and that is because the maggots, when they...
Are you talking about fly maggots?
Yeah, we're talking about blowfly maggots.
All right.
This was something discovered in World War I. There were a couple of soldiers who'd been lying around in the bush. They were brought in for medical treatment, and they have these large open wounds. And it's Dr. William Baer. He takes a look at them. Everyone is revolted because these wounds are full of maggots. And they wipe them out. They try to, you know, kind of get rid of them, because assuming that that's not a good thing. And then this guy, Dr. William Baer, he sees that when you take away the maggots, it's this really healthy pink new tissue that's there. There's no infection. And normally you would expect to see infection. So he saw this over and over, and he realized that what they were doing, what a maggot does is it's debridement, which you have to do when you have a bad... When you have a wound, you want to get rid of all the dead tissue, and that's often done surgically. But the maggots go in and they dine selectively on the dead tissue.
Ugh.
And that encourages the healthy new tissue to grow in. And they're also they also prevent infection. This guy, William Baer, he tested, I think it was 69 patients who had recurring infections that wouldn't respond to other treatment. And in only two cases was there any infection.
How do they get rid of the maggots when they've done whatever they have to do?
Yeah, this is the thing. This is you can get them from, they're available by prescription only.
I hope nobody's having a plate of spaghetti right about now or anything.
I hope not. Or rice would be bad.
Right. Wiggly rice.
Yeah, don't
eat. But how do they get rid of the maggots?
Okay, so yeah, the thing is the maggots... You have to have a nursing staff, because you only want to leave them in a couple of days, because maggots want to eat as much as they can and then take off and pupate and become a fly, and you don't want that in a hospital scenario. So you have to change the maggot dressing, and it's a cage dressing. It's a dressing that you put on to keep the maggots from wandering away from the wound. I mean, they don't want to wander while they're feeding. They basically want to stay in there. There's a dosage. You don't want to have too many maggots per square centimeter, because then there's not enough food and they'll stray. And again, you don't want the maggots straying. So there, you put them in, you've got this cage dressing to keep them there, and they're doing their thing for a couple of days, and then you got to change the maggots. And that's why you need a trained nursing staff to do that. It's certainly not something that one would want to do oneself, but anyway, so that is maggot therapy, and it's used. You know, the origins were from World War I, but today it's often prescribed for diabetics who have these foot ulcers that heal very slowly or not at all, and the maggots are kind of the last hope before you would possibly have amputation. So these folks who have it done. I mean, it is a kind of a gross thing to imagine a wound on your body with these creatures there. But when the alternative is to lose a foot, it's something people are willing to deal with. And some of them even kind of get involved in the process. I was talking to a doctor who has a lot of diabetic patients, and he said that they kind of get into it. To the point where they might wear the company that sells the maggots has you can get a T-shirt that says "Maggots on Board." Kind of embrace your maggots, and I think there's some appreciation for them. And honestly, I've seen them. There was a researcher at Walter Reed who was looking into using it for some of the IED injuries, and he showed me. You know, he said, "Just, you know, he put one little maggot on my finger, and it's like a cupcake sprinkle. They're before they're fat and older, they're kind of They're kind of sweet.
Oh.
They look like a little, they're kind of inchworming along, and
Next thing
they're
you're going to tell
light.
me is a little plate of them would taste good. Yeah.
No,
No. I mean,
not
has
very much.
anybody been sewed up with maggots still in them by mistake? I mean, because they've sewn up people with instruments in them.
Yeah, they sure have. It wouldn't be the end of the world. I think the thing would die, and you'd probably absorb it. I mean, they fight infection. That's another kind of amazing attribute of the maggot. The maggot is an interesting thing. When you put it in a, when you introduce them to a wound, they kind of go head first down into the tissue, and they just are there feeding, and they just stay there. I mean, all a maggot does is eat, and then it leaves and becomes a fly. It just eats, and it breathes through its butt, which is, again,
Oh, that's an
interesting and
interesting
strange.
way to live,
Yeah,
huh? I love it. Okay, so next one. How to escape from a submarine. Now, are you talking about one that's submerged?
sunk sub. Yes, sunken sub.
And most of the time, they're down too deep to be able to come out, right?
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, the that is a problem if the water is very deep. I mean, but submarines are like airplanes in that most of the collisions and incidents are going to happen when you're coming into and out of port, or similar to an airplane coming into and out of an airport. So yeah, for the most part, when they're out at sea, they're not likely to collide with anything. So and if you're close to port, the water's hopefully not that deep. And you can escape from a submarine. For a long time, you couldn't. It was a death sentence. But this guy, Swede Mommsen, Charles Swede Mommsen, was the first to come up with a couple of ways of getting out. One of them, if there's a rest, it's kind of a like a diving bell that clamps on and it takes people to the surface. And that's something they have perfected, and they've got those kind of deep submersibles that will go down to like 2,000 feet. That's one way. But if the sub goes down and it's 600 feet or so, you can actually get out just yourself with a little suit, and they
That's
have this thing
amazing.
and it's escape trunk. That's the tricky part. You really got to be trained for that, because
Well,
in order to
here's the
open
other
a
problem.
hatch.
If you have a sub of 50 guys,
Yeah.
I mean, some of them aren't going to make it.
Well, some, yeah,
The
some, well.
sub will fill up with water by the time the rest of them get out.
Well, they've got compartments with the watertight doors. So that, you know, if the outside is breached and water is coming in, yeah, the people in that compartment probably, some of them aren't going to survive. But they close the watertight door, that'll stop the flooding. And a submarine has enough oxygen. They've got plenty of food usually, because they're down often for months at a time. So they're designed to give you 7 days survival on the sub. So you do have some time. But if there's fire, if it's filling up with smoke, if there's like chlorine gas being generated because the salt water is hitting the batteries, I mean, there's situations where you've got to get out right away, and so that's when you would use the escape trunk. But yeah, it's one person at a time. So, you know, there might not be time for everybody to get out. And they have a practice pressurized escape trainer over at the Groton Submarine School, which is enable you've got to be able to clear your ears, because you've got to equalize the pressure. And you're in this tank, and the water's coming in, and you're kind of filling up your suit with air, and you're clearing your ears. It's a pretty stressful thing. And the very first time this escape trunk system was used was on the Tang, which was sunk by its own torpedo. Kind of
I
turned
remember
around, came back.
years and years ago when the Thresher went down,
Oh, right.
and we
Yeah,
lost
yeah.
all
Well,
those
that
sailors.
imploded, right?
Yeah, that
Yeah.
got crushed. That got crushed.
Nope.
Mary,
Yeah. Nobody got out of that one.
we're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come back and talk some more about some of these very bizarre things that they do at war. And then I want to get into your other book, of course, which is called Packing for Mars. They found a couple lakes on Mars, they think, today. And if that's the case, there's life out there for sure. But let's talk about that too when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, Mary Roach with us. We've been talking about her book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Tell me how you've gotten into this. You're almost like a little Freudian person, someone who likes the strange, unusual, and bizarre.
That's exactly right. I wandered into this. I was in India, and I was in Nagaland, which is way up in the northeast where they grow this very hot chili pepper. I was writing a piece that had to do with this, the world's hottest, arguably the world's hottest chili pepper. And in the course of reporting it, someone said, you know, the Indian Defense Ministry weaponized this chili pepper. They made a kind of a like a tear gas, only a powder. And I thought, well, I kind of need to report on that. So I went over to this lab in the neighboring state that is run by the Indian military, and was talking to these guys and was hanging out there. And the science arm of the Indian military does some interesting stuff. They were working on a leech repellent, which, you know, they were going to go down to the river and roll up their trousers and test it. They also had done in the past, I learned, and this was something I would have loved to include in the book, they had done ESP work, and that would have been telepathy, in fact, would have been great to report on, but that was in the past, and they were not doing anything else. They also had this famous, you guys may have reported on this, but there's some Swami over there who claims to not have eaten anything in over a decade.
I heard about that. He yeah, drinks his own stuff, as soon as
I thought he was living on air. But anyway, what it fascinated me was that the Indian military had studied this guy because they thought, well, if we could learn something from him, then if we had troops who were in remote areas who had nothing to eat, perhaps they could employ the techniques of this Swami. And I thought, well, military science is really kind of interesting and esoteric, and that might be an interesting place for me to hang around for a couple of years. And the Swami thing had already happened. I saw the paper. There was like 15 experts and medical people they all brought in, and there were other people saying, oh, it's got to be fake. But I don't know what the, I don't know exactly what the story is, but what fascinated me was that the military chose to put him in a hospital, this guy, this little bearded guy, mm-hmm. and study him and see, you know, is he really able to do it, and what is there something unique to his physiology that we might be able to learn something and apply it to our troops.
Now, you've also looked at the history of the stink bomb.
Yeah, the bad
smell. I haven't heard that in years.
Yeah, there were the history and also the current work over at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. But the original story that I report on, and I got the old it was a secret file from the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, and the OSS was inspired by the Brits. They had an S liquid or stench liquid that was. It was a foul smell that you would. The idea here was to create a cheap and small pocketable weapon that would be distributed to resistance movements in occupied countries in World War II, like France or China, and you'd put this in the hands of citizens. And this was a tube of the vilest, most off-putting smell that science could come up with, and you would squeeze it. You know, as a citizen, you'd see, say, a German officer, and you'd sidle up behind, and you'd squeeze it onto their uniform, and it had all this, like any weapon, there were specs. Like, it had to be lastingly penetrative. It had to stink for at least 2 hours at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. There could be no backfire. It had to withstand rainfall and dry cleaning fluids. I mean, there were all these specifications that had to be, and then they set about testing it. And in fact, there were all manner of problems with the delivery system. There was leakage. There was backfire. In fact, there was dribble. So it took a long time to get it right, and then the company, the chemical company who had manufactured it, the Arthur Little Company, they came back just when they were ready to actually create a bunch of these units. They said, well, actually, this is not going to work on the Oriental population. They have a different set of things that they find acceptable. So they did a Mach 2 version of this. They did another version of the stink spray.
Jeez.
And in the end, the final report for this item, which was called Who Me, because it had a fecal smell, like who dealt it, who me. This is the OSS. This is end of. I have the file. I have the correspondence. It went on for 2 years. But anyway, the final report was released about 2 weeks before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So we went from stink bomb to
yeah.
real bomb.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Mars. They think they found a couple lakes out there, by the way. If that's true, I think there's life there, too. You never know. But
yeah.
You talk about packing for Mars. Tell me about that.
Well, packing for Mars, it's a book about human beings in space and the physiological and psychological challenges of long-term life in space. So it's not really a book about Mars. The Mars is in the title, sort of like packing for space, packing for. So I'm not a the book's not about Mars, but So it's more about well, for example, with a Mars mission, some of the things that the psychologists and the physiologists worry about. I mean, on a Mars mission, you've got cosmic and solar radiation, and you're
right.
out there
and
for
boredom.
A long time. And what? Boredom, exactly, because especially on the way back, you can imagine on the way there, you've got the excitement of being the first people on Mars.
Yeah, but how long are we? Well, they're talking about a new spaceship with a propulsion system that would get it there within days, but that's far, far away from now.
So
what are we talking about? 2 years to travel?
Yeah, exactly.
2.5 years?
Yeah, I mean, there was a simulation up in Moscow called Mars 500, and the 500 is for 500 days. But yeah, two years, depending on what position the planets are in relative to each other, it could be a couple of years. And can you imagine coming back, kind of the anticlimax? And also, how do you keep the things that you learned that you've got to do before, when you get there, you've got to be kind of rehearsing those in your head. And I mean, even there was, it was Eugene Cernan, I think it was, on the way to the moon. And the moon, this is a quick trip.
Yeah, three-day trip.
Yeah, exactly. And he says, this is a quote from him. He says in his memoir, yeah, funny thing happened on the way to the moon. Not much. Should have brought some crossword puzzles. I mean, you're going to the moon, and I mean, there's nothing to do. There's not a lot to see out the window.
And that was only 3 days. So you think of two
exactly.
and a half
so
years
a Mars
or
mission,
more.
I can't even imagine. And also, I talked about in the book the psychology of isolation and confinement, because you've got people stuck together in a small space, no way to really relieve. Normally, how do you relieve stress? You go for a run, you drink, you take a bubble bath, you go shopping. I mean, all the things that we humans do to relieve stress, you don't really have that option. Plus, you depend on these people for survival, so you want to work things out with them. But it's tremendously, people get very frustrated, even on just, the International Space Station or Mir, there were reports of a lot of depression, because if you're angry and frustrated,
and what if you don't get along with one of them, one of your astronauts?
Exactly,
oh,
right.
My gosh.
There's no way to get. I mean, you can't leave and slam the door and go out for a drive. You're stuck. You're soaking in it.
Well, and the craft has got to be big enough where they've got like a treadmill there or a cycle or something. You're going to have to do some kind of exercises, or your muscles will deteriorate.
Exactly. Your muscles and your bones in weightlessness. It's use it or lose it. Your muscles waste away. Your bones get very thin. So they've got to come up with way. I mean, hopefully it would have one of those rotating components, so they'd create gravity, so you wouldn't have all that muscle wasting. But the depression. I interviewed some cosmonauts who had been on a long mission, and there was a lot of psychological
Were
problems.
they on the
And I asked
ISS?
about what?
Were they on the International Space Station?
No, they were cosmonauts on Mir, and
Oh,
I asked
really?
them
One of the
about.
first space stations.
Yeah, and I said, so what were you depressed? And this guy said, he said, yeah, I had tell you, Mary, we were. I was so depressed. I wanted to hang myself,
Oh,
but of
gosh.
course, there's no.
No place to
You
hang.
can't. You can't. Nothing can hang.
What was our first space station? You remember?
What
You're
was that?
close. You're close.
I was gonna say Salyut, but that was
No.
the first. That was before Mir. The UF one before ISS.
Skylab.
Yes, thank
Yeah.
you, Skylab. Absolutely, Skylab. Yeah.
And then down it came. Down it
And then
came.
down it came.
Well, I think if we get propulsion systems
Yes.
to a point where we're traveling almost at light speed, then we're gonna, be able to get to Mars and get there relatively quickly and things like that. But until then, I think humans will be bored out of their mind. I mean, they're even trying, Mary, as you know, to find people, and they have the volunteers who want to go on a one-way mission to Mars. They're not coming
Yes.
back.
No, I know. I know. It's kind of extreme immigration. And the thing is, there are astronauts right now in the astronaut corps who would do it. Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space, she's like, sign me up. She told Putin, I
I
want to go
wouldn't
to
do it.
Mars.
I
He
don't
said,
want to live in
why?
some pod.
No,
I want to see a storm come in, or the sun, or clouds, or stars at night, or my grandchildren and my kids. I don't want to give that up.
No, exactly. I can't even. And just you talk to astronauts about, who've been on the ISS for a long time and coming down to Earth, and just feeling a breeze on your skin, and what a luxury that is.
Edgar Mitchell, the late astronaut, Apollo 14, one of our dear friends, and we've lost him a short time ago. He told me that the feeling was so exhilarating, just being out there and then coming back, looking at Earth, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he said it has a profound effect on you in terms of your belief systems, what you think about God and everything. And he was right. He was right, Mary. I mean, can you imagine going off into space, going to the moon, walking there where few humans have ever been, and then coming back? I mean, that's gotta be just awe-inspiring.
Oh, I think, and it was a profound experience for a lot of them, and it's just amazing, like. Because the combination of, NASA, where everything is so rigid and organized. I mean, some of the Apollo guys talk about in the mission transcripts, you could see they'll say, okay, so, and we've got, and at this particular minute, we've got 30 seconds just to look out the window. Like,
Yeah.
even just gawking out the window and going, holy crap, we're landing on the moon. That was built in to the schedule. And, just it was this scientific endeavor, but you can't just
Would
science
you go to
out
the
the
would you go
wonder
to
and
Mars?
awe.
Would you go to Mars if they asked you to?
I'd go to the moon. I'd love to go to the moon. Mars, are you kidding me? No, I'm
You
not
wouldn't
gonna
do it. You
launch
wouldn't
no.
take the 6-year trip or whatever it would be back and
No,
forth.
God, no, absolutely not. It sounds awful to me. It sounds awful. I mean, you could just sort of teleport me there for
Be
10
a
minutes.
fun interview with you on Mars. We could put you on the show, take phone calls.
Right,
Maybe
I'll
we
do
could
it.
call you like every year, see how you're
No.
doing.
Yeah,
No,
send me some
I
more
wouldn't do it.
Cheetos.
I wouldn't do it. Did you see the movie The Martian?
I did, yeah, and
Yeah,
I thought it was great. Did you read the book? Was pretty
I didn't
amazing,
read
didn't you?
didn't read the book, but the movie was great, and they played a lot of our bumper music in the movie, which was kind of cool. I have a feeling the writers have listened to this program before,
I think so.
but
I think so.
there's just like, I was just saying that they think they may have found a couple lakes on Mars. That's an astounding discovery if that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, like remnants of lakes or
No, like
current,
really
like.
liquid current lakes.
Oh, is this? I didn't. This is this just today?
Yeah,
This
it
came
was
out.
all over Yahoo. I spotted it a couple hours ago.
Wow, actual liquid lakes.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. They're not
Wow.
sure, but who knows?
There's got to be some bacteria. I mean, like they find that it's amazing. You can, they're what are those little tardigrades? Those little bear,
Yeah, but
the
I
little
want
bear.
real life. I want thinking type humans up there. That's what I want. You believe in life? You believe in extraterrestrial life like us out there somewhere?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Why? Why do you believe that?
Just so many solar systems that have the right, where they got the star and the planet is the right distance to support life. And there's just so many of them that I can't imagine that there isn't some sort of life that's fairly well evolved. I just think the odds are in its favor. I'd be shocked if there wasn't.
I
Wouldn't
agree.
you?
I agree. Do you believe in God?
Define God.
Some higher power that somehow got involved in the complexity of all this.
I think
It's not a fluke.
is it, yeah, it I could wrap my mind around that as easily as around the Big Bang. I mean, the Big Bang, I'm like, well, what happened before
I don't
then?
get that. I
What
don't,
happened before?
what was before the Big Bang?
Yeah, I know that I can never wrap my head around that. But then also God, I'm like, who made God though? Where'd God come from?
Well, my
He
mom
must
would
have
always
to.
say, always was, always will be.
Yeah, my mom would say, you gotta have faith, Mary.
There's no answer to that because you'd go crazy trying to
Right?
figure it out.
I know, it would blow your mind.
And I think some theologians take the easy way out and, they talk about the stories of what God might be, but, in a very religious sense. And, for people who believe that, that's great. I don't know what it is other than I know this is not an accident. It's not. But
Yeah,
Elon Musk,
right.
of course, believes that we are living in a computer-generated world. That we are nothing but artificial intelligence, and that something has created us as a life form.
Is that right? Is that what he said?
Yeah, that's
Wow.
bizarre.
We're part of someone else's computer program?
Yeah, that they concocted and created.
Oh,
Man, I
man.
hope they never have a software issue.
Yeah, I'm telling you. That's like the scene in Men in Black where the universe is hanging on the thing on the cat's
Yeah,
collar.
exactly. Exactly. You never know.
You never know. I know.
What's the next big discovery? What do you think? What'll happen?
The next bit, like the internet, that kind of that big.
Something, whatever. Whatever it might be, what do you think it'll be?
I think we're gonna go headlong into
I think it'll
man,
be
it's so many.
teleportation.
Oh, teleportation.
That's what I
What
think
about
the.
even just what about even just flying individual flying cars?
Yeah, that's
What
going to
about?
happen eventually.
Yeah.
And we're going to have accidents, let me tell you.
I know. I guess
Even
we're gonna
if
be.
the technology is there to avoid an accident, it's going to happen. People are going to be falling out of the skies.
I know, yeah, and the drone thing. Where is that? With drone deliveries, is
Oh,
it going
that's
to be like
crazy.
zipping overhead everywhere?
We're going to take calls with you next, Mary. Folks, come up with some great questions about things you've heard us talk about next.